session number 12502, and this is Reel 5.
Field Marshal Lord Bramwell, Reel 5. Were you involved in the Rhine crossing operations?
Yes. By this time, because I'd been a platoon commander pretty solidly, as you heard from the landings onwards, I was made intelligence officer of the battalion. And so that was really the commanding officer's tactical headquarters. And I remember the Rhine crossing very vividly, because the battalion was going to cross as soon as the bridge had been got across, to exploit the airborne drop, which had been launched at the in-depth gun areas of the German defences. And it was the most amazing. I was with, we crossed with 15th Scottish Division, and of course we saw this great armada coming across to land the American and British Airborne Divisions, 6th Airborne Division in this case, and they were landing on the gun areas, and they were landing in broad daylight. And it was a very, very formidable feat, and of course they suffered quite considerable casualties, particularly to the gliders. But they got down and dealt with the gun areas and in-depth positions, and that enabled the assault crossing to break out almost at once. I don't quite know why I was there, but I crossed fairly early, and I remember linking up with a friend I knew in 6th Airborne Division about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, in the midst of the German depth positions. And this ensured that there was going to be no Normandy bridgehead with enemy ringing it and unable to break out for quite some time. And as soon as that was over, that was really the last great battle of the Second World War. I won't say the Germans didn't fight. They fought remarkably well from the Rhine crossing to the end of the war in early May of 1945. But the writing was completely on the wall. And they had to fight with all sorts of what the army would call odds and sods. Cadet academies, marine divisions. When I say marine divisions, I don't mean like the Royal Marines. I mean marine divisions from naval shore establishments, Luftwaffe divisions, Home Guard, anybody they could lay their hands on. And they did defend on each one of the rivers to some extent, Dortmund Ems Canal, the Leiner, the Weser, and really right up until the war ended at Hamburg.
The airborne operation the airborne operation, that Rhine crossing, dropping in depth onto the enemy gun line, was that the first time that had been done?
I think it was. I mean, it was dropping right on top of the enemy defences. And, of course, there was massive air protection. There was no fighter aircraft, but there was a lot of anti-aircraft still. And it was terrible to see the damage that they did to the air landing brigade in gliders. We saw destroyed gliders all over the place. But it had to be coincide with the actual river crossing, and therefore it was really forced to do it in daylight.
Because I understand that at some stage Montgomery had a plan to use the First Airborne Division to drop south of Caen during the Normandy campaign, do a similar sort of thing to land in the gun area of the German defences around Caen. At the time of Epsom or Goodwood, he had ideas of using airborne.
Well, I know. I mean, one of the reasons that Arnhem had to go ahead even though the last-minute intelligence was that there were probably two SS Panzer divisions actually sitting in or around Arnhem, was that the airborne forces had been stood to and stood down and stood to and stood down so often, the whole way really from Normandy upwards, that they really felt they couldn't keep them in suspense any longer. They thought morale would be strongly affected, and therefore they thought they would push out of their minds the thought that there probably were quite a lot, unexpectedly, of German tanks in the Arnhem area, and they would go ahead of it. And, of course, as far as the first two rivers and bridges were concerned, it was a triumph of success. But it did turn out to be a bridge too far.
In your new role as intelligence officer, what did you actually have to do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, one was really the colonel's personal staff officer with his tactical headquarters. I mean, I had to do a lot of other things as well. I mean, obviously, one had to get what intelligence one could. One had to organise the immediate questioning of prisoners and things like that. One had to see that proper information was in the hands of the company commanders. One had to... I remember when the... various other bits of equipment were coming in to join the battalion group. You had to see that they had tied up already. But you mostly had to accompany the commanding officer as his personal staff officer, while the adjutant, which I later became, manned the main headquarters.
How big was the battalion headquarters?
Oh, very small indeed. Just the commanding officer, intelligence officer, and some signallers and so on. Yeah.
Were you responsible for actually providing information for the troops, because you were saying earlier on that Montgomery had it as an absolute principle that you've got to tell the soldiers as much as possible about everything, and it was logical for that to be working.
Well, that's not quite the way it was done, of course. That, although this slipped because of there wasn't really time, but in the set piece battles, of course, it came down to the commanding officer normally briefed everybody on what the battalion was going to do. But you had to make certain that the companies were getting the information that was available about the enemy disposition, for example.
Did you get a lot of useful intelligence out of questioning prisoners?
Not really, no, I don't think. You got a little bit, I think, but not too much. It depends on who they were. If they were an officer or somebody who really knew anything, they didn't say very much. And you hadn't got time to do it with them. I mean, they were just passing through. You had a language problem. Did it with interpreters. You might get some intimation, but you couldn't be certain it was right.
And was it also your function to deal with reports from patrols?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. And to produce a sort of patrol plan, and also to get information from them to see if it was... But generally speaking, you were the staff officer who the colonel had with him all the time.
So, in effect, you were really not just an intelligence officer, you were the colonel's general factotum.
Absolutely. Mm.
And what sort of things did the colonel use you to do besides your intelligence functions?
Well, you accompanied with him. He passed on orders for you to see that were disseminated in the proper way. So his maps were kept up, marked up to date. You saw his headquarters was sighted in the right place, came up when it was needed, camouflaged, defended, and that sort of thing. I mean, there was quite a lot to do as battalion intelligence officer.
Did it give you more contact with brigade headquarters
as
well?
Yes, I think it did. I suppose that's where I got more to know the brigadier in that capacity than I had done as a platoon commander.
How did the brigadier run his headquarters? Did he run it on a formal basis or an informal basis?
Well, he was, of course, a tank man, Field Marshal Carver, and Brigadier Carver as he was then. So he did a great deal of work on the air. He had, as a brigade major, a very able man who became a full general. General Ward, Sir Richard Ward, and a lot of orders and things were passed on there. And he then came with his intelligence officer round the various units when that was necessary.
Did he go in for conferences, or did he not bother with that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, it depends what you mean by conference. I mean, he went in for, of course, O groups, order groups. Commanding officer was occasionally summoned to brigade headquarters to get orders. That happened from time to time, and he issued his instructions, orders, and the commanding officer came back. And, of course, it was the intelligence officer's job to see that those orders were passed on down to companies with whatever the commanding officer wanted added to it.
So after the Rhine crossings, then, presumably the brigade made its way up towards
Yes,
Hamburg.
We were in the lead there from then onwards, and we had battles at a place called Raytham, which was over, I can't remember which river. Raytham was over the Leine, that's right. No, each river... There were battles. You had a bridge. You got a bridgehead, which either you got or someone had got for you. The bridge had to be built, and then you had to go across and fan out using as many routes. And we continued in this vein, moving past the house that I eventually lived in for 2.5 years as divisional commander. And our final operation was to cut the Bremen-Hamburg Autobahn and then to go into Hamburg. And we drove into Hamburg on the last day of the war, May the 8th or 9th, 1945. And 2 days later, we were ordered up through the milling mass of people in Schleswig-Holstein into Denmark to... supervise the march out of the German forces in Denmark.
Now, you said that the Germans carried on resisting with improvised forces after the Rhine crossings. Did you notice that they became less enthusiastic or less effective as time went on and you penetrated deeper into Germany? Or did they maintain a sort of consistent level
of limitations? I thought they were pretty consistent, really. I thought they fought very well right up to the end, and after all, by that time they had nothing to lose. I mean, they were fighting in their homeland just as we would have been if they'd fought in this country. And, of course, to some of the Germans, not all of them, of course, but to some of the Germans, the Nazis, it was the prospect of the end of the world. I mean, they thought that the Germany without Hitler was... they might as well not be living. They'd been the top dog, they'd been the master race, they'd been all these things, and to be a defeated nation, and that the whims of the Allies, they just didn't think it was worth living. I won't say that was all so, and of course with the older people, they didn't feel quite like that, but the younger ones mostly did. And as I say, it was an extraordinary, eerie experience, because... 30 years later, I was commanding a division. My house was on the centre line that we'd advanced 30 years before. Just up the road, I could go over a bridge, turn right, and there was a little German church and cemetery. And in the cemetery were rows and rows of graves of the German Marine Division killed on the 16th of April 1945, and they were all people that had been killed in a battle with my battalion. And I lived 2 years with this just up the road from me. Very extraordinary experience in a Germany which had completely changed. And Hamburg, of course, bore no... I mean, Hamburg was the most appalling thing I'd ever seen. I had this unusual experience of, in the matter of a few months, seeing both the ruins of Hamburg and Hiroshima. And to my mind, there was no doubt which the most awful was, and that was Hamburg. And the reason was that it was a modern city. You could tell it had been a modern city. The concrete and buildings were twisted and torn. There was rubble everywhere. Old people pushing barrows and so on. It was the shape of things to come of H.G. Wells. When you got to Hiroshima, remember the whole city, apart from about three buildings perhaps, had been built of paper and wood. And so when it was destroyed by the atom bomb, you never got the impression there'd been a city there at all. It was like some rather slightly untidy park with roads running through it. And there was really no sign of a modern city. So Hamburg, in some ways, was much more awful.
What was it like then dealing with the Danes when you were escorting the German army out of Denmark?
Well, the Danes were friendliness in itself. I mean, they were absolutely marvellous. The hospitality was wonderful. One had come from war conditions and a war-torn UK to a land that looked very prosperous, because there again, that was a food-producing area. And they couldn't have been more welcoming or kind or anything else. But of course, what was interesting was dealing with the Germans, because we had to deal with the Germans' generals and their staffs, and we saw something of their Teutonic efficiency. If we wanted a German division to move from A to B, and we wanted it to put its heavy equipment here and its vehicles there and something else, every order we gave them was carried out exactly to the letter, without any argument or fuss or dragging their feet or anything, and impeccably done. And they kept discipline right the way through.
Did you have a German liaison officer attached then? Or?
I think we must have had a number of German liaisons, depending on the formation coming through. I'm sure while the formation was coming through, we had a German liaison officer. And we didn't deal just with the liaison officer. We expected the German divisional commander to appear with all his staff tables and everything at our battalion headquarters. And he did.
What was the demeanour of these Germans?
Well, the first time we came across them, driving up into a place in southern Jutland, we had the whole of this German division singing as they went through the town. They're very impressive. And we had to order no singing at all, otherwise it would have been wondered who'd won the war.
They didn't look...
They were not those. Those were kept their discipline, of course. The scenes in Schleswig-Holstein, when you were getting refugees and Himmler disguised as a corporal in the security service and all these things, there was absolute pandemonium. And, of course, a lot of refugees, because, of course, what everyone was trying to do was get away from the Russians and surrender to the British. But they were extraordinary days.
Did you get involved with administering refugees?
Well, we didn't, because we went up into Denmark and there were no refugees, the only refugees were the German army marching out. Other people did.
Were you just in the portion of Denmark, just north of the German border, or did you go up into there?
No, there were two regiments, ourselves, the 2nd King's Royal Rifle Corps, and the Royals, Royal Dragoon. And we were in Jutland, and we covered the whole of Jutland. Battalion headquarters was comparatively near the border in a place called Orbenrå, but we had companies right the way through Jutland at strategic points, and the Royals went to Zeeland, which is where Copenhagen is, to the island of Zeeland, although we drove up into Copenhagen, and I was in Copenhagen the day they reopened the Tivoli Gardens, which was a remarkable fiesta.
Did you have any incidents of Danes attacking the Germans as they were withdrawing or attempting to molest them in any way?
Not really. No, they didn't. We had a pocket battleship in Orbenrå at the long side, and the crew were interned there on their ship, which we guarded and controlled until some arrangements had been made for them to be taken somewhere else. And they were extraordinary days. But I wasn't there very long. I was there until early July, and then I went out with the airborne forces to Southeast Asia.
Did that happen because you had volunteered, or were you chosen?
I did volunteer, together with several others, because we felt that many of our regiment had been in the war since 1940-41, and I'd only been in action since 44. I'd been in the army at the end of 42, and there was still a war to go, so we really thought we ought to go out to the Far East.
At this point, had you already decided that you would like to have a military career?
Yes. I did two War Office selection boards. I did the first one in 1942-43 when I got an emergency commission. And then I did one when we were in Holland and Belgium. I came back to somewhere near Brussels, I can't remember when. And I did a second one for a regular commission. So, I think the regular commission didn't come through, but I was certain that that I wanted to do this. And, of course, by the end of the war, I was a major at 21. So it seemed like a sensible thing to do to stay. I did actually have a place at Christ Church College, Oxford, which had come through towards the end of the war, but I felt that I really didn't want to sort of go back to school again. And so I stayed on out in the Far East and let the military career take its course.
What would you have read if you'd gone on to Christ Church?
Well, it's a very good question, but a lot of people, my contemporaries who did, then promptly left the army and went into other things. I might have, I suppose, have done that, but I had been reasonably successful so far, and I'd survived. I've got a lot of great deal of experience, which, of course, would have taken normally years to acquire, and so it seemed a sensible thing to do.
But what subject would you have read if you'd gone to Christchurch?
Oh, I think history almost.
Not medicine.
No, I would have quite liked to be a doctor. You're perfectly right. I could have quite enjoyed it, but I think I'd have read. Yes, that would have been a problem I'd have had to have tackled. Of course, if I was going to be a doctor, I would have had to have taken something on the medical side. But history was the thing that always fascinated me.
So you'd volunteered to go out to the Far East, and presumably at this stage you hadn't heard of the atomic bomb.
No, nope, not at all.
The prospect was of a...
And when we'd heard it had been dropped, we didn't really understand what had happened. But from whatever had happened flowed the fact that the Japanese had agreed to an armistice. And very shortly afterwards, of course, the airborne forces started to come back to England because they weren't needed to drop in Johor. And I found myself in a staff appointment, and that I didn't have anything to have. So I came up with the British and Indian Division going to Japan for the occupation.
How did you actually get out to the Far East? What route did you take?
Getting out to India, I went in a DC-3, which took off from Yeovilton, and it stopped as follows. The first stop was Nice, the second stop was Malta, the third stop was El Adam, the third stop was Lida in Palestine, the next one Habaniya in Iraq, the next one Bahrain, and from Bahrain to Karachi, and then to Bombay. No, not Bombay. Karachi, it must have been somewhere in central India, because we ended up in Gwalior, near Agra. So that was getting to India, and then going to Japan, again a DC-3, from Bombay this time, to Rangoon. Rangoon to Bangkok, Bangkok to Saigon, Saigon to Hong Kong. We stayed a few days in each place, a week in Hong Kong, 1946, and Hong Kong to Shanghai, and then we got into a unheated Sunderland flying boat and flew across the South China Sea to Japan.
What impression did Japan make on you when you got there?
Well, it was the Japan of Madame Butterfly and Pinkerton, not the Japan of today, of Coca-Cola and fast food and all the high tech and everything else. It was a very old-fashioned place. The women in their traditional dress, carrying the babies on their back, everybody living in houses made of wooden paper. I lived one in one myself, bathing in a thing looking like a cannel pot. And very primitive, very very attractive, very really, and no great sprawls of high technology as there is now.
What was your actual job?
Well, I was the staff captain AQ, which had a lot of problems. It had all the personnel discipline problems and all the supply problems of being long way from either India or England, and my sixth superior on the A side, the personnel side, was an Indian for whom I'd just been visiting in India last week, and my boss on the Q side was an Anglo-American married to an American wife, Indian Army. Wonderful divisional commander called Cowan, who commanded the 17th Indian Division of Burma for 4 years. Great friend of the. And I was there nearly a year before coming back and getting into the mainstream of the British Army again.
You mentioned personnel and discipline problems. What sort of problems did you have to deal with?
Quite a few at the end of the. First of all, leave and repatriation of people who've been overseas for a long time. We had, at the end of the war, there was quite a lot of discipline problems, really. And in Japan, of course, we had awful problems with venereal disease. We had problems of black market. We were in proximity to the Australians, who were marvelous soldiers, but they were quite a rough lot. And, we did have small mutiny. In a Gurkha battalion, of all things, but it didn't last very long.
What was the cause of the mutiny?
It was a magnificent battalion, the 2nd, 5th Gurkhas. They had three Victoria Crosses actually serving in the battalion. They'd suddenly come to a world where they saw what was happening to the Australians and New Zealand roundabout. They got out of their depth, a bit big for their boots, and they had a commanding officer who slightly lost his nerve. But my divisional commander stopped it in about half an hour. He told me to get in the back of the jeep, and he drove into the Gurkha camp, had them all up, cursed them in Gurkhali, and the whole thing was over.
What form did this mutiny take, then?
Not sort of obeying orders and not saluting officers and doing things like that.
It sounds though they hadn't. Was it a mutiny?
Wasn't a mutiny. They didn't kill anybody or shoot anybody or anything like that. They just fed up.
They got fed up. So there was
no
organised movement or anything like that.
No, I don't think that. No, I think it's putting mutiny is perhaps a bit of a strong word, but non-cooperation.
And do you know why they developed that attitude?
I think it was a mixture of being rather restricted in what they could do and go out and leave barracks and things when they saw the Australians and other British troops doing much more. I mean, I think they were being run on too tight a rein. And they were, men of very considerable experience and so on. But it was over in no time at all.
And you mentioned the Australians. Presumably with the Australians there were difficulties with drinking and fighting.
Fighting, drinking, some crooks coming up from Sydney to join the force to get in on the black market. And things like that.
Did you ever have any difficulty with the Japanese civil population?
None at all. Absolutely none. I mean, they went from being, as you know, cruel and unpleasant people to being utterly subservient and doing everything we told them. We had no trouble at all.
Which part of Japan were you actually in?
We were in a place called Okayama, which was between Kure. Kure is the port very near Hiroshima. Hiroshima is just a bit to the west of Kure. Then you come to Kure, and then halfway between Kure and Yokohama and Tokyo, you have this place called Okayama, which was on the inland sea. And the southern end of the inland sea is an island called Shikoku. And the force had a British brigade, 5th Brigade from the old 2nd Division, an Indian brigade commanded by a very fine Indian officer called Timaya, who later became chief of their army staff, and then mixed gunners, Indian and British, mixed engineers, Indian and British. And the whole force was fascinating, and we had a mixed Indian-British mess, mixed European and Indian food. And it was my first contact, really, with Gurkhas and the Indian Army, which, of course, I had to renew later on.
What work was the force doing? Were you patrolling the streets?
Yes, we were showing the flag more, really. I mean, we didn't actually have responsible for administrating the civilian population. That was done by the Americans under General MacArthur. We were there to show the flag, to reinforce law and order, to see that, because one didn't know that there wasn't going to be a sort of resistance movement or something being done, to see that that didn't happen. And generally to show the flag and make it clear that Japan was being occupied.
Did you see anything of the remnants of the Japanese op-